Did you know anyone who got hurt on the fire?
Well, I know one man who was a workmate, my husband. Two sisters got burned. His two sisters got burned in that fire. He's not living no more. That man to die already. But they always used to cry to my husband how their two sisters got burned.
A cousin of mine, his mother-in-law worked there. And I remember it was at a Seder that she told us how her hair was burnt. She was left without hair. Otherwise, she was saved.
And then there was a young lady who was supposed to get married a week after. So she came and brought some wine and cake to three the girls, and her boyfriend came up together, and the both of them got burned.
I don't know too much about the fire, but because I was very young at the time. But we lived in the neighborhood of the Governor Hospital that sent out the ambulances to the fire. It was a Saturday, and my mother had one baby in the carriage, and I was to stand and watch him. And as he had just come down from the stoop, when the ambulances started to run one after the other, that's all I remember. I can almost hear them running now, clanking.
At 6:45 p.m., firemen began to search for bodies inside the building. They took each body to a waiting casket and tagged it. By 9 o'clock, they had carried down the bodies of 50 women, charred and dripping. They spread a great canvas of dark red on the sidewalk and laid the dead in rows among the ambulances and throbbing fire engines. When the bodies were covered, police crossed to the sidewalk under the windows and picked up the belongings that the girls had clutched when they ran to the windows. There were many leather handbags, broken combs, hair ribbons, some pay envelopes, parts of clothing that had been torn off in the wild rush to safety.
In the same house, just the next door for me, was a girl was living there. She was an immigrant. She just came to America. In the same evening, the same Saturday night, she was to be engaged. In the same Saturday she was born, she was the victim. Was what I know. I remember Jette Goldstein. She was landslide. Bialystok, I remember that. But I was very friendly with her. The fact is, I was invited to her engagement the same night. She was the victim.
How long had she been working at Triangle, did you know?
Well, she was working maybe about 7-8 months. She was only, I think, about a year in this country. She was saving money to bring over the family. She had family in the old country.
No, I waited in Europe.
You heard about it?
Was in all the papers, certainly. I wasn't in a small town. I was. I had an uncle that time, the whole family in Minsk.
When this happened, my stepsisters were here, and they were around there. I don't know whether they were working there or not, that I can't tell you. But I remember that my father took us all around the table, and they told us the story. We were 9 children, I was the 8th one. And we were all crying bitterly. And then we asked our father, how could a thing like that happen in a place where people are working and making a living? How could it happen, a fire, and they should burn it like that?
My aunt worked in the neighborhood, not exactly in the same shop. And she saw the whole hall of the workers jumping through the windows, and because they had no other way of getting out when the fire burst out. So she wrote it in a letter, but then she also sent to my mother a part of a newspaper where the whole thing was written up.
Those stories, I remember there was, everybody was crying. That time wasn't any telephones. They, nobody knew so quick. So they used to run around the houses and find out that who survived and who was killed, who burned.
At 1 o'clock Sunday morning, March 26th, the gates of the ferry dock, which had been turned into a temporary morgue, were thrown open to the hundreds of men and women who waited for hours to identify their dead. Police with lanterns guided them down the long rows of tagged bodies. Small groups clustered around caskets, searching for familiar features or clothing. Cries in Yiddish and Italian were heard up and down the dock. Rosie Solomon stopped at box number 34, staring at a pocket watch on the body. She asked a policeman if she could open it, and saw inside her own picture. She had found her fiancé, Joseph Wilson. It wasn't too long before Serafino Maltese found the body of his 20-year-old sister, Lucia. Then he found the body of his other sister, Rosalie, age 14. Although nurses tried to stop him, he didn't rest until he located the body of his mother, Catherine. On the Lower East Side, where most of the victims lived, the streets were filled with weeping men and women. Workers stood in the streets talking about the shops. Some were trying to recall whether or not theirs had fire escapes, while others were figuring out the best way to escape a fire in their building. Soon after, the first funerals began.
We went to the funerals, you know, in Grancid. All the funerals used to be in Grancid.
What were the funerals like?
Oh, it looks to be very sad. One after the other they came. Young, you know, young people.
And of course, after that, we had protests, we have demonstrations, we have protests in halls that the people were called together, and thousands upon thousands of people demonstrated and protested it.
Oh, marched after I marched. Everybody was marching. We were terrible. It was terrible. We couldn't forget it till this day. Everybody was suffering together with the mothers, with the parents who were left, who lost young children. Those two girls were 19 and 20 years old only that I lost.
You cannot describe how the people went around. Some of them people had their friends, their children, their cousins, their, you know, 146 victims, except others where they were have brain were in the hospitals and all that. It was something I'll never forget it as long as I live.
The girls, it's no use to not to pronounce their name because they are gone. They are. And I was there, then I was to the march. And it was to the funeral, which it took a long time to go. Now I wouldn't have been able to go. And Hefta, it's no use to repeat, but it was Hefta. You know, the parade, the marches, and the everything. I didn't let go anything.
Gefinds mich dorten mit mein Schatz. Wo Lebenswelten bei Maschinen, dorten ist mein Ruheplatz. Dorten ist mein Ruheplatz.
3 days after the fire, the garment trade papers carried the following advertisement. Notice, the Triangle Waste Company begs to notify their customers that they are in good working order. Headquarters now at 911 University Place. The building department inspected 911 University Place 2 days later. It found exits already blocked and fire escapes closed off. The Triangle Company collected $64,925 in indemnities after the fire. That averages out to about $445 per worker killed. The families of victims were not so lucky. Most of the women killed in the fire were breadwinners. In at least 12 instances, a family lost two or more workers. Survivors did what they could, and donations by the thousands poured into union and private relief groups. The money helped pay for food, rent, funeral costs, and the support of families in Naples, Bucharest, and Vilna, as well as New York.
The young women of Triangle knew 2 years before the fire that their building was unsafe. Fighting for better conditions in 1909, they joined their sister workers from other shops in the largest strike by women in the history of American labor. 20,000 shirtwaist workers from more than 300 shops in New York City struck not only for higher pay and shorter workdays, but also for an end to insults by foremen, an end to being charged 25 cents for a hat locker, an end to buying their own needles and thread at a profit to their employers.
When did the union first start to come into Triangle and try to get people to join and to organize? This is before 1909.
Well, there were rumors about starting an organization, I should think around 1905, maybe a year or two earlier or later. I can't recall the exact date, but there were quite a lot of noise about it, but not much action. And so people went to some meetings secretly. Nobody would tell on anyone else. And if anyone went to a meeting, it was found out, it was fired immediately. But we had no special organizers before 1909. The secretary, the president, some people of the from the United Hebrew Trades and the East Side, they were trying to hold meetings. And the Women's Trade Union League, which came into being in 1903, held street corner meetings in front of the factories to try to get the girls interested. And that sort of a thing went on and on until 1909, when the climax resulted in the strike.
The strike began with a walkout in the Rosen Brothers shop after the employers refused to pay inside contractors a new rate. Workers at Triangle soon joined the walkout. Word of the strike spread by hearsay throughout late 1909. In November, officers of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, Local 25, called for a mass meeting at Cooper Union to consider a general strike.
Well, whatever the union, Cooper Union Hall holds, it was jammed, and people stood outside the hall because they couldn't get inside, you see. And it really wasn't a very long meeting. Everybody felt that the time has come to act. And so Clara Lemley got up and made a motion that we strike. There was bedlam in the hall and reached on the outside of the hall, too. And everybody shouted, strike, let's strike, 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 and strike we did.
The girls left the shops the next day, November 23rd. One striker remembers,
When we came back to the factory, no one went to the dressing rooms. We all sat at the machines with our hats and coats beside us, ready to leave. There was whispering all around the room. Should we wait like this? Who will get up first? Then I started to get up, and at just the same minute, all of us got up together, in 1 second. No one after the other, no one before. It excites me so yet to tell of it. We all stood up and all walked out together.
The strike centered on the larger shops like Triangle. Hundreds of young women, considered unorganizable by the male union leadership, walked the picket lines daily.
What was the feeling on the picket line among the girls? Was there singing while you picketed?
Yeah, we used to go around, we used to sing, we used to walk, we used to joke, we used to, you know, in the old day, of course, you know.
What did you sing?
All kinds of, you know, Russian songs and Jewish songs and revolutionary singing, you know.
Employers responded by forming their own associations, hiring prostitutes to taunt the pickets and thugs to escort the strikebreakers to and from the factory. Picket lines at shops became targets for violence.
Gangsters, yes.
They would come in and
gangsters used to hit. They used to come with sticks, and they used to, if you annoyed a scap or anything like that, they were right in the back of you.
They beat the girls up?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, many times.
I think they all showed courage. For instance, they, in the first place, they withstood the attacks from the police. You know, in those days, the police used their clubs generously. Judges were no better than the police. We'd send the girls up to what we called at that time Blackwell's Island, which is now the Welfare Island. One of them was sent for 2 weeks to stay there just because she was picketed. Others were threatened to be arrested, but they didn't mind. They would get into trouble with the judge, and he would release them, and they would start all over again. You know, this is so courage. When the judge tells you that, you know, young lady, you're not striking against your boss, you're striking against God. And when that young lady continues picketing, I think she showed courage.
Soon they needed more than courage. The strike stretched into December and then January. Bitter weather cut down pickets where thugs had failed. Although many of the smaller shops began to settle, Triangle continued to refuse agreement.
January 19th. I suppose we'll all keep up to the end. It can't last much longer, after all. The season's now in full swing, and the orders have to go out. What these bosses don't resort to. Helen drew my attention to an advertisement in one of the newspapers this morning. The Triangle wants waist makers, promising them from $15 to $20 weekly, free lunch and dancing during the noon hour. No wonder they're so anxious to get workers. Their place has been closed the fourth month. I met several of their strikers today, and upon my word, they didn't seem half as upset as their bosses. Only that their faces have dwindled down almost to nothing, and their clothes are so shabby that they could hardly get work in a decent place.
How did the girls live during the strike?
During the strike? Of course.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. But see, at that time, the union didn't have any money to pay yet.
So how did people eat?
It's very hard. Wherever they lived, they didn't have no, like, for instance, I lived by a missus. She had to wait till the settler strike and to bring her for the room, the $6 a month. She was willing to wait because her husband was a worker too, not by this trade, by other trade. You know, she'll come. She understood.
Help came from other places. The sight of so many young women organized in the streets for the first time caught and held the attention of the general city press. The Jewish and the socialist papers donated issues to the cause. College women from Vassar and Wellesley joined the lines and provided information to the public. Women's Trade Union League members picketed, collected strike funds, gave classes on strike organization, and retained lawyers. By February, membership in Local 25 had grown from 100 to 10,000. It was the beginning of a strong union spirit.
Well, everybody said the strike was settled. We had a little bit better conditions, a little bit more money, less hours. It was gaining.
On February 15th, the union declared the strike settled with only 13 firms still holding out against the strikers. Triangle was one of them. Workers in other shops won a 52-hour week, 4 paid holidays, and an end to some of the worst abuses of the contracting system. But there was no fire safety. Employers defeated demands for adequate fire escapes and open doors to the street. Triangle workers went back to the building with unmarked exits, open gas flames, and locked doors. Yet under state law, this building was considered fireproof, and in the aftermath of the Triangle fire, it was hard to fix the blame. The fire department blamed the building department for failing to correct fire hazards. The building department claimed that the health department had jurisdiction inside shops. The health department accused the water department of negligence. One thing was clear in the crossfire of accusations. No agency had the power to enforce its own rules. State labor law made these rules so vague and overlapping that it was common to have 5 or 6 agencies intervening in one factory.
8 months after the fire, Isaac Harris and Max Blank, Triangle's 2 owners, were brought to trial indicted on 7 counts of felony manslaughter. It was claimed that Harris and Blank were committing a misdemeanor by keeping the Washington Place door locked. If the prosecution could tie the workers' deaths directly to the locked door, Harris and Blank would be guilty of manslaughter.
I stayed home 2 weeks, and I used to go every day in court because they were speaking all in Yiddish. All in Yiddish.
You went every day to the trial?
Yes, every day. With all my friends, naturally.
The trial lasted for 3 weeks. 155 witnesses were called. Witness after witness testified that the door was locked.
And the trouble was the doors from the fire escape was locked. They have no way of saving themselves.
Well, there were fire escapes, but I never knew how to get there. We had no instructions at all in case of a fire.
But then the fire broke up. They didn't know where to go. That's why they got burned.
Everything was closed. The door wasn't closed outside. It should come out from, but inside they couldn't get out.
The building was absolutely a fire trap.
As I recall it, I don't think the fire escapes were safe enough. Although it might have saved a number of lives if the doors were open, the doors were not open.
This I'll never forget it. But the bar and the way it used to lock, be a lock on there, I should not be able to go out. Mm-hmm. That's the only door that used to be able to go out.
There was absolutely no fire prevention or nothing.
And a shop, this was absolutely the biggest crime that anybody can do, to lock up a shop from thousands of people in case of a fire should not be able to save themselves.
Although the prosecution produced a charred door frame and lock as evidence, several witnesses swore that the door was often unlocked during the day and that the key hung from a string nearby. At the end of the testimony, Judge Crane told the jury that in order to find the owners guilty, the evidence must show not only that the door was locked on March 25th, but also that Harris and Blank knew it was locked on that day.
After 2 hours' deliberation, the jury returned the verdict. Not guilty. Parents and friends of the dead girls jumped to their feet in the courtroom shouting, "Murderers! Murderers!"
Do you remember what you felt like or what people felt like when the trial started? You know, the 2 owners went on trial, right?
Yeah.
Blank,
yeah,
and Harris,
yeah,
went on trial. What did people think about that?
Well, they thought that they should go away for prison for their lives. But they didn't.
Public outrage at the fire had to be answered. With pressure from unions and citizen groups, the state government set up the Factory Investigating Commission. The commission was given power to investigate the entire range of workers' conditions in factories. After 3 months' testimony, the commission recommended laws which were enacted in the next 4 years. These laws required fire sprinklers, fire alarms, and monthly fire drills in factories. Fire escapes were redesigned and were made mandatory on all buildings. The number of workers was limited according to floor space. Exits had to be clearly marked, doors had to open outwards, and stairways were widened. No door could be obstructed or locked at any time. The fire department was given full inspection and enforcement power.
When I came here in 1913, I was interested to know how the shops are now. So I heard and I read and I was talking about it. They told us that now they're building fire escapes in every shop. They have all kinds of protections in the shop that if anything should happen, people, workers can go save themselves.
It was a beginning. But leaders in the labor movement as well as workers knew that legislation without agitation was not enough. Organizer Rose Schneiderman said,
"This was not the first time girls have been burned alive in the city. Every week I must learn of the untimely death of one of my sister workers. Every year thousands of us are maimed. The life of men and women is so cheap and property is so sacred. There are so many of us for one job, it matters little if 146 of us are burned to death. I can't talk fellowship to you. Too much blood has been spilled. I know from my experience it is up to the working people to save themselves."
Such mich wo Fontanen spritzen, gefind's mich dorten mit mein Schatz.
My sister still remembers the day, of course she passed away already. Then every year she used to say, "I pray for the people."
Mein Ruheplatz, dorten ist mein Ruheplatz.
This program was produced by Beth Friend and Stephen Stowe for the Public Affairs Department of WBAI New York. Special thanks to the Workman's Circle Home and Infirmary for the Aged, Bronx, New York, to the Jewish People's Philharmonic Chorus, and to all those who shared their memories with us. Technical production by David Rapkin.
I still can see the fire now. It was so many years ago.